Stars Over Surrey with Dave Gemmatis and John Extell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.
In these days of the coronavirus, John and I are in separate places, both at home, but the show must go on. We're going to talk about the world of spaceflight and astronomy, constellation of the month, what to look for in the night sky next month. But first, what's happening in spaceflight and astronomy then, John?
Well, hello Dave, and hello listeners. Well, May has been quite a busy month, especially in terms of spaceflight activities, so let's press on. And I'd like to keep it local to start with. Here we are, Brooklands Radio in lovely Surrey. And you'll be pleased to know that Surrey will soon be at the moon. The European Space Agency has recently announced plans to establish a GPS navigation type system and also a telecoms network around the moon. And this is going to be called Moonlight. It set up a feasibility study to assess the viability of this, and so that a business case can be built and put to the European ministers that have to approve expenditure by the space agency. And the idea is that astronauts with this GPS-like network in place would know exactly where they are as they travel in orbit around the moon or are landing on the moon or of course, in rovers travelling around the moon's surface. And it would also help them to land with excellent precision. So two consortia have been invited to submit studies, to undertake studies and submit proposals. And our local company, SSTL, Surrey Satellite Technology Limited, is heading one of those. SSTL, as listeners probably are aware, is a spin-off from the space science section at the University of Surrey. There's still a British involvement in the other consortia. There's a London-based company called Inmarsat, who are specialists in satellites for navigation and communications with shipping, worldwide shipping. And that, so they are involved in the other consortia, which is headed by an Italian company called Telespazio. SSTL believe that three or perhaps more orbiters are required to give the appropriate kind of accuracy which would be needed, which is less than the accuracy we have here on Earth, which has to deal with densely urban areas, roads, etc. So 30 metres accuracy is all that's required for the moon. But those orbiters would probably be backed up by some ground stations as well. So it'll be interesting to see if SSTL becomes the leader of the winning consortium. And I think they stand a very good chance. They've actually already committed to self-fund and build a mission called Lunar Pathfinder. And that's planned to be in orbit. Obviously, they won't orbit it themselves. They'll contract somebody like Rocket Lab or SpaceX to launch it. But their Lunar Pathfinder should be in orbit by 2023 or 24. And that could, in fact, act as this proposed Moonlight Network's first node. Lunar Pathfinder itself is going to be in a highly elliptical orbit, which means that at its furthest part, it'll be visible from the moon's surface for longer. And the part from which it will be visible longer will be the South Pole, which, of course, is where NASA's Artemis mission plans to land during 2024. So the satellite would appear to be loitering over the South Pole to maximise the time it's available to act as a communications relay satellite. So interesting to see local expertise stretching out as far as the moon. Let's move further out now, Dave, and see what's going on the red planet. So up at Mars, Ingenuity, that little helicopter that the NASA's Perseverance lander and rover took with it to the Martian surface, has been doing brilliantly, really, really well. I've mentioned it before that it was a demonstration device for purely to prove the technology that we could build a helicopter that would be able to operate in the very tenuous Martian atmosphere, which, remember, is only 1% as dense as that of Earth at sea level. And it's done really, really well, as I said. The first plan for it was just to do that, just to demonstrate that it would fly. And that was over five flights of increasing complexity over a period of 30 days. Now, after its fourth flight, they decided it's done so well, we don't need to do any more just to prove the technology. We can now move into a different mode, one that they now call operations demonstration, and one that they didn't know for sure whether they'd be able to do or not. But I'm glad to say that the mission for Ingenuity has been extended by a further 30 days. So on its fifth flight, which is now in this new mode, earlier this month, it flew one way to a new airfield, as they're calling it, you know, a nice, safe, flat area. And this is 129 metres away. And it's one that they thought was nice and safe, but it selected it itself. It confirmed that it was nice and flat. Normally, Ingenuity flies at 5 metres, but what they did with this one was it took it over to the new aerodrome at 5 metres, but then flew to a new record height for it of 10 metres, so it could look a little bit wider and make sure that there wasn't anything that might cause problems for it. And indeed, all was well, and it settled down there. So now it's preparing for its sixth flight, which should take place early next week. And in that one, it's going to fly 150 metres, so even further, to a place that Perseverance has already identified as being of interest, or rather, you know, NASA has identified as being of interest through the images that Perseverance took as it descended. Apparently, there's a patch of interesting sand there. And what they want to do is to fly Ingenuity over it, taking photographs as it goes, so that they can turn these into stereo images, which will help to work out the height and depth of the troughs and ripples in the sand. And once it's done that, it's then going to fly a further 50 metres to a new landing area. Now, in the past, as I understand it, Perseverance has been taking images, photographs of Ingenuity as it's been flying, and I gather also lending some of its own processing power. But now Perseverance will be completely on its own because Perseverance has switched from its Ingenuity support mode into a preparation phase for its own survey work. So it won't have the time to switch off to attend to Ingenuity. So Ingenuity is completely on its own now. It's solar powered, so it's been able to survive the cold temperatures overnight on Mars. Remember, Mars has a day that lasts about 24 and a half hours. Apparently the power retention from these solar cells is such that it's actually been flying for longer than they thought. They thought it would probably be something of the order of 1.5 minutes per day, but it's been up to nearly 2 minutes without draining its reserve. So it's an all-round great success, tremendous news. Of course, ingenuity and perseverance aren't alone on Mars. They've just been joined by the Chinese Mars lander, which touched down earlier in the month. So China's become the second country to successfully soft land on Mars, following America. And also the second to deploy a rover onto the surface. There is a little debate. Some people say we ought to count Soviet Union's Mars lander that did actually touch down, and operated, but it only operated for 2 minutes before it failed. So I'm not sure if we can really count that. However, the lander separated from the orbiter called Tianwen-1 on Friday the 14th. And then used the usual sort of system of slowing itself down from its orbital velocity by the shape of the heat shield on the descent vehicle. So that's called aeroshell braking. And then once it had slowed to, you know, several hundred miles an hour, it then deployed a parachute, having ejected the heat shield. And then when nearly down, separated from the parachute and used retro rockets to bring it to a safe landing. And that landing took place in a part of the northern hemisphere of Mars called Utopia Planitia. The rover, which is called Zhurong, has now sent back its first pictures. And in the slides that accompany this programme, listeners will be able to see that picture. It's looking back at the lander, where there's a ramp that can be seen down which the Zhurong rover descended and rolled off. So it weighs 240 kilograms, so that's a little bit larger than a couple of previous NASA rovers, the ones called Spirit and Opportunity, which both landed in separate places on Mars in 2004. This one is solar powered. So it won't last that long. It's got an expected lifetime of about 90 days. However, that's not the end of the mission, because the Tianwen-1 orbiter is still in orbit, and that will continue to operate, surveying the planet for a further 2 years. So, well done, the Chinese. But landing on Mars isn't the only notable thing that the Chinese Space Agency has done this month. They've also started off their new space station, much larger than the previous Tiangong 1 and Tiangong 2 stations. So the new space station, which I imagine will still be called Tiangong and possibly 3, that has been launched insofar as the core module, which is called Tianhe, has been launched by China's heavy-duty rocket called the Long March 5B. And that name, Tianhe, means harmony of the heavens. So that's a very large module, 16.6 metres long, 4.7 metres in diameter, and weighing 22.5 metric tonnes. And that was launched, you know, fully fueled. So it can maneuver as necessary. Now, it will be joined by two similarly sized units, which will be collected together in the form of a T. And to completely build this, it's going to take 11 missions between now and the end of 2022. And the first of these missions is expected to be the launch and arrival of a cargo vessel. Their cargo vessel is called Tianzhu, and that's similar to the Russian Progress or the American Dragon, etc., that take supplies up to the International Space Station. What that will be doing will be taking up supplies, food, oxygen, fuel, etc., for the first manned mission, which is expected later in June. And that's going to be for a 3-month stay on the new space station. So when it's completed, it's expected to be similar in size to the predecessor to the ISS, which was the launched by the Soviets, the Russians, and that was the Mir space station. So it's going to be about the same sort of size. And that is considerably smaller than the ISS, but it's an excellent start. The plan is that once it's fully assembled, it will be permanently manned by a crew of three, but with room for a maximum of 6 people on board during the changeover. The Chinese manned space capsule takes 3 people. So there'll be 3 on board. A replacement crew of 3 will come up, dock at one of the ports, transfer in. They'll stay together for several days during handover, and then the original crew will depart for a period of 3 to 6 months, leaving the new crew on their own. However, although that was a success and applauded, I'm afraid there was quite a lot of condemnation of the Chinese Space Agency about this, in the sense that the giant central core stage of the Long March 5B entered orbit in order to deploy this core module. But that meant it didn't have any fuel left or capability of reorienting itself so that it could come down in a controlled way, in a safe way. So it could have come down anywhere, especially if it started tumbling in orbit. And this is a big beast, this core stage of the rocket, 30 metres long, 5 metres wide, and 21.5 metric tonnes. Eventually, it did come down, we believe, mostly over the Indian Ocean. But there are some reports that some may have come down across the Arabian Peninsula somewhere. But that is, sparsely populated, so there's been no reports of any problem. Now, when something that size comes back down into the atmosphere, you would expect most of it to burn up. It'll get buffeted by the atmosphere as it starts to descend. And at the speed it's going, that's effectively a huge wind which will tear it apart. But it's thought that somewhere between 20 to 40% would survive and hit the ground. So that means that it could have been something like 10 tonnes that actually came down. And if that had come down in a habited area, then that would have caused quite a lot of damage and potentially loss of life. So America have had a pop at China. The administrator of NASA has accused China of failing to meet, and in quotes, responsible standards. But the Americans aren't clean on this score themselves. I mean, Skylab, their initial space station, came down with chunks, I think, landing across Australia. But overall, everyone now is much more aware of these sorts of risks and are putting into place measures so that there will be much more in the way of controlled descent of things that like spent stages. But probably the next two modules for this space station will have to be launched in the same way by the same rocket, Long March 5B, with similar uncontrolled core stage re-entry, which is a shame, slight tarnish to this splendid new venture by the Chinese National Space Agency. And what a busy month it's been for SpaceX as well. On the 2nd of May, they completed the first commercial crew mission under that contract with NASA by bringing back the four astronauts who'd been on the ISS, having been taken up by SpaceX's Crew Dragon. So they were up there for 5.5 months. And then they separated from the ISS and came down for a nighttime landing just off the Florida coast with quite spectacular infrared images taken by aircraft and ships of it coming down. And I was quite amused when the company's capsule communicator radioed to them, thanks for flying SpaceX, and said something about you've earned 68 million miles on this voyage for their frequent flyer program, which is a nice little touch. So that's one big activity for SpaceX. The other one particular note a couple of weeks later was Starship prototype SN, serial number 15, has managed the first successful soft landing for a Starship prototype. So this one was the first of a new block of prototypes, which incorporated lots and lots of improvements that have been gathered from the previous four flights, serial numbers 8 to 11. And listeners will remember that the flights of all of those four were successful, but they just couldn't quite manage to get the landing right and crashed, burnt, blew up, whatever on landing. But this one, as they say, stuck or sticked it well. So a great a feat, because that's a massive vehicle. A tweet from Elon Musk has suggested that they might refly that same prototype to learn even more from it. And there is really quite spectacular footage, which listeners can find on YouTube. Just key in SpaceX Starship into YouTube, and you'll find the footage of it taking off, disappearing into the cloud, sadly, but then landing successfully. Quite spectacular sight that was, and what a tremendous step forward they've now made. Some other SpaceX news for this month. They've recently announced plans. They've filed them with the appropriate authorities in America for the first orbital flight of Starship. So this means it has to be launched by a Super Heavy, which is the first stage. So Starship itself is big enough, but Super Heavy is even bigger and just has Starship mounted on top. So this is a sort of not a recovery type mission, though. The date for that hasn't been set, but hopefully they hope by the end of this year. The idea is just to test the launch of the two together, the separation one from the other, and also the orbital procedures. And it's just going to be a single orbit, a 90-minute flight, And as I say, neither rocket will be recovered, because that will add an awful lot more complexity, and that will take place in a later mission. But they'll try to simulate soft landings. The Super Heavy will be off the Florida coast. They're not launching from Florida, by the way. They'll be launching from Boca Chica, which is their base in Texas. So it'll launch from Texas, fly over the Gulf of Mexico, past the Florida coast, where they will separate, and Super Heavy will come down. And be lost, obviously. Starship will continue up into orbit, and that will go round the world and then come down, not back on mainland America, but just off Hawaii. So that will be an interesting development, but perhaps they'll have several more Starship serial number prototype flights before then, because the first of the orbital ones is believed to be SN20, and at the moment it's SN15 that has just succeeded, and it would have to be a different prototype, because it would have slightly different engines. The Raptor engines that they've been using up until now in their prototypes have been configured for operation within an atmosphere, whereas if you're in orbit, then the rockets will have a slightly different bell shape, slightly different configuration, because they're tailored for orbital operation. Obviously, the final operational Starship will have a mixture of both atmospheric Raptor engines and vacuum Raptor engines. One other thing that they've done this month is set a new record with their Falcon 9s. One of them has now been launched and recovered 10 times. So that really is demonstrating the reusability, which is one of their prime drivers, for bringing down the cost of launches. This one was ferrying up yet another batch of 60 Starlinks, their broadband satellites, into Earth orbit. And as part of that, they've actually had an incredible launch cadence of five Falcon 9 launches in a period of just 3 weeks. Now, that takes an awful lot of logistics and management behind the scenes work. That's quite a feat. One other little development for SpaceX this month has been the award of a contract by a company that itself is under contract to NASA to land spacecraft, relatively simple spacecraft, rovers, etc., on the moon, preparatory for the Artemis project. It's all data gathering missions. As I understand it, there are six missions under this NASA contract with various commercial companies to get landers onto the moon. Unmanned, obviously, and SpaceX have been contracted to deliver five of these six. So yet another feather in the SpaceX cap. Now, of course, in the commercial field for manned spaceflight, Elon Musk does have two high-profile competitors, Jeff Bezos with new Blue Origin, and, of course, Richard Branson with Virgin Galactic. So a little bit of news about both of those. So Blue Origin have now announced the date, which is July the 20th, for their first passenger-carrying suborbital hop using the Blue Origin New Shepard rocket. three of the four crew are expected to be Blue Origin personnel, But one seat will be filled by the winner of an online auction. And currently, that bid price is standing at $2.8 million. Which is a lot cheaper, of course, than going up into orbit. Remember, this is only a short, 6 to 10 minutes or so in weightless suborbital hop. It has been wondered, though, whether Jeff Bezos might be one of the Blue Origin personnel to go on the very first flight. That would really put Elon Musk's nose out of joint, I suspect. Whereas Richard Branson has hinted that he will be flying on a suborbital hop soon, following the very first flight of the Virgin Galactic space plane, VSS, Virgin Spaceship, Unity. The first flight, that is, from its new operating base called Spaceport America, which is in New Mexico. That had a successful flight up to 55 miles high. Remember, NASA declares the boundary of space to be at 50 miles. For the rest of the world, it's 60. But there you go. And I understand there'll be two further proving flights before passenger flights commence. But it shouldn't be long before Richard Branson and others will be up there. Now, there's been two separate private flights to the International Space Station announced this month. The first of them, due to go on October the 5th, is by Roscosmos, who on a Soyuz craft, captained by a Russian cosmonaut, but they will take up a Russian actress and also a Japanese filmmaker for a 12-day mission to the ISS to shoot some scenes for a film. So that will probably put out the nose of Tom Cruise, who has been talking about flying to the space station to do exactly the same thing with a filmmaker. But they believe they'll be going up with SpaceX when a date hasn't been set for that. The other mission, again, Roscosmos flying two people for another 12-day mission, and that's due to launch on the 8th of December. And that is for two Japanese people. And it's interesting that, I'm terribly sorry, I can't remember his name, but the Japanese chap who's paying for this and taking his assistant is the same guy that has already contracted SpaceX to fly him and a bunch of other people around the moon, probably either next year or the year after on a Starship. So he's going up with the Russians in a Soyuz and then round the moon in a Starship. So it's obviously not short of a bob or two. The knock-on impact of these two missions, private missions to the ISS, is that a NASA astronaut called Mark van der Heij will have to stay on board for what will turn out to be a record-breaking 353 days until there's a seat for him to come back on a Soyuz. He went up on the last Soyuz on April the 9th. Now, he knew this when going up, that his trip would either be 6 months or best part of a year, depending on whether these other flights were confirmed, which they now have been. What with all of these private flights that have been announced, we're entering nowadays a different sort of orbital world in terms of the mixture of professional astronauts and private astronauts. Over the next 7 months, there are going to be 12 private astronauts reaching orbit. and that's the same number of professional astronauts, either from NASA, the European Space Agency, or Japan and Canada sent via NASA, Russian astronauts, cosmonauts, of course, and Chinese selenauts. So, for example, these 12 private people are made up from, in September, SpaceX are flying 4 private people in a Crew Dragon. That's on a just into low Earth orbit, not visiting the ISS, and that's a charity fundraising mission. And then the two that I've mentioned, October, the Russian and Japanese to the ISS for the film stunt, and then the two further Japanese in December, and then in January, Axiom, the American private company, Axiom Space, is contracted with SpaceX to take 4 private people to the ISS in a Crew Dragon. So by that time, there'll be 3 Chinese on board the new Chinese space station that I mentioned earlier. Other news, OSIRIS-REx, the NASA asteroid probe, has now left orbit around asteroid Bennu, where a little while ago, of course, it collected very successfully over 60 grams of 4.5 billion-year-old pristine dust left over from the formation of the solar system. Its journey is going to take 2.5 years because it's got 1.4 billion miles to cover. And then the sample capsule will parachute down into the Utah desert in September 2023. In the past, Dave, I've mentioned the solar cycle, that we have a maxima of sunspots and a minima, and we've been in an extended period of minima over the last few years. But the sun is indeed waking up. We are into the new cycle, and there are again sunspots appearing. And on the 22nd of May, one of those, numbered AR2824, really exploded. It unleashed 12 solar flares within the space of a day, and that is quite something. In the slides accompanying the talk, there's a photograph actually of one of those solar flares leaving the sunspot. And one of the explosions was so powerful that a radio telescope, which was trying to do its ordinary observing, and in fact had been thwarted in that because of a local thunderstorm, found that even the thunderstorm was drowned out by the signal that was coming from that solar flare. So it shows how powerful it was. Now, when a sunspot ejects material like this that leaves the sun's surface and flows out through the solar system, we call this a coronal mass ejection, or usually abbreviated to CME. So that the material from one of those explosions did indeed brush past Earth's atmosphere on Wednesday the 26th, causing a minor geomagnetic storm in our atmosphere and presumably some aurora. So it's good to see that the sun spot cycle is starting up again. Indeed, there's a new quite big sunspot that's just started. It's about to go behind the other side of the sun as the sun rotates, but it looks as though that's going to be big enough to survive the journey all the way around the sun, and in a couple of weeks' time it should be visible again, and a lot larger. I know, Dave, that I've mentioned supernovas on the programme in the past. I don't think I've mentioned NOVA. Nova, from Latin, meaning a new star, is when a star that didn't seem to be there is suddenly visible because it's become an awful lot brighter. Now, the word perhaps gets associated with supernova, and hearing it the first time, people might think it means that an exploding star means that the star is dying or has blown up. No, that's not the case with a nova. A nova always involves two stars, and both of them carry on living after the event. What happens is that the stars are in close orbit around one another, and one of them will be a small but incredibly dense white dwarf with a very strong gravitational field. And that can exert its effect upon its companion, which is often a star much like our own sun, and it will drag material from that star down onto the surface of the white dwarf. And that material will be compacted under gravity to the point, and heated up to the point where nuclear fusion begins, and you get a massive explosion like a thermonuclear bomb, but much more powerful. But that explosion causes the brightness, the increase in brightness, I should say. Now, the reason for saying all this is because there's one of these that's visible in the night sky. It was discovered back in March, and at the time wasn't visible naked eye. But in May, this nova has suddenly brightened by a couple of magnitudes and is now naked eye visible, just about. It depends on whether you live in a dark enough sky area and your eyesight's good. It's at magnitude 5.3, but certainly it can be found in binoculars. And it's in the constellation that many people will know called Cassiopeia. So if you can find your way to Cassiopeia and use the star map that's included within the set of slides that accompany the programme, then you should be able to work out which one is the nova. Well, just watch it over several nights, because it's thought now that it's reached maximum brightness and will start to fade again. For those of you that know the night sky a little bit better, then it's actually just 24 arc minutes. That's just less than one moon's width. From an open cluster in Cassiopeia called M52, Messier 52. So it's just below M52. So the photograph and star map that I provide should help you to find your way to it. Okay, Dave, listeners, that concludes my roundup of news items that have interested me, things that have occurred during May, mostly spaceflight related, but a couple of astronomical ones as well.
Thank you, John, for the update.
Stars over Surrey, constellation of the month.
So what is the constellation of the month then, John?
And my constellation of the month is Bootes, a constellation not so well known because it's not on the zodiac. But it's a nice constellation. It contains Arcturus, one of the brightest stars in the sky. No Messier objects, so there's a nice one nearby. But it's got some splendid double stars within it. So I hope people would like to find it and look around it with binoculars or a small telescope. So what constellations have we got for June? Even though, of course, it is much shorter nights, there is still some good sights to be seen in the night sky. We've got Leo still over in the west. And below that into the southwest, we have Virgo, great area for galaxies, of course. And above that, we have Cancer. And then my constellation of the month comes next in the south, that's Boötes. Then we've got, moving further into the southeast, we've got Hercules and Lyra. And then over in the east coming up, we've got splendid constellation of Cygnus. And of course, behind Cygnus and going further south through the southeast, towards the south, we have the Milky Way, which is starting to ride high at this time of the year. We're starting to look at the core of the Milky Way as we go further down towards the horizon into the southeast and south, where we have those splendid constellations of Scorpio, Ophiuchus, and also Sagittarius coming up. And there are some really, really good deep sky objects to be found by the more serious amateur in that part of the sky. If you're into looking at the moon, then the best time to be observing it in the evening won't be until about a few days either side of the 18th, when we're at first quarter, or if you're an early bird, a few days either side of the 2nd, when it's at third quarter. New moon, best for deep sky observing, because the sky will be that much darker, is on the 10th, and full moon is on the 24th. And of course, the nights, as I say, are drawing shorter. The sun is rising at 4:51 at the start of the month, and stays at that sort of dawn time throughout the month, give or take, and setting on the 15th, for example, at 9:20. So it really is a much, much shorter night. We've got the summer solstice, of course, on the 21st. There is one particular event that I'll mention that is probably the most interesting to people, and that is a partial solar eclipse on the 10th of June. But do make sure, if you want to look at it, that you've got a pair of eclipse glasses, maybe from some previous eclipse, because even looking towards the sun with naked eye can cause eye damage. So please don't look at it through, even if it's behind thin cloud, with the naked eye, or particularly with binoculars or a telescope. But the eclipse starts at 10:06 and finishes at 11:13, with the maxima of about 12:24. And at most, there'll be about 25% of the sun's disk will be covered by the moon. Because elsewhere, further north, going up towards Greenland and across to Siberia, this is going to be not a total eclipse, but an annular eclipse. That's one where the moon, which is at its furthest point in its elliptical orbit around the Earth, isn't big enough to cover the whole of the sun, and so we get a what seems to be a ring of fire of the tiny little fraction of the sun all the way round the disk of the moon. The best way of looking at this, if you don't have properly filtered telescope or eclipse glasses, is to take your binoculars or a telescope and project the image of the sun onto a white card. That's perfectly safe, and works very, very well. So that's on the 10th of June in the morning between 10:06 and 11:13. Other events during the month, Jupiter's quite close to the sun on the moon on the first. And on the 12th, of Venus and Moon make a nice pair, about 6 degrees apart. And on the 29th, Jupiter is quite close to the Moon, but that, of course, is in the pre-dawn sky. And, of course, I should tell you about the other planets during June. Mercury starts off as an evening object for the first few days of the month, but very, very low in the west-northwest, and only about 30 minutes after sunset, and then it starts to disappear into the twilight from the sun. So it becomes a morning object at month end. So best seen at the very end of the month, about 40 minutes before sunrise in the east-northeast. Venus is an excellent bright evening object, shining at magnitude minus 3.9 in the west-northwest all month, from about half an hour after sunset to about 1.5 hours after sunset. Unfortunately, it stays fairly low, so it doesn't rise that high, but it's so bright it's unmistakable. Mars can be found, you know, with a telescope, but it's virtually lost in the summer twilight. Other planets virtually lost this month include Uranus and Neptune, but both Jupiter and Saturn are visible. Jupiter, a bright morning object, magnitude minus 2.5, low in the southeast, and that's rising towards 3 hours before the sun at the start of the month, 5 hours by month end, which will actually take it before midnight, as indeed happens to Saturn, rising about the same sort of time, a couple of hours before the sun, low in the south-southeast, but before midnight, before the end. Not as bright as Jupiter, magnitude 0.4, but its rings, if seen through a telescope, are nicely tilted towards us, so it makes a nice object. Obviously, still no meetings at local societies, but plenty to be found online and free. British Astronomical Association has got several meetings on Wednesday the 9th and also Saturday the 26th. So have a look at the slides for the details of those. Society for Popular Astronomy. Usually Friday nights are on the SPA's Facebook page, but it's not a talk, it's a chat show, but a chat with astronomers, with sometimes professionals, sometimes amateurs, can be fun, with Vicky Video, usually a Friday, but have a look at the Society of Popular Astronomy's Facebook page to find the details. A couple of talks also on Saturday the 5th, two on the same day, from the British Interplanetary Society. So look at there again, the slides for details of those. And you can also, all of those are free, but you can also pay to watch events, talks from a company called Go Space Watch. You have to book via Eventbrite. They've got talks on the 2nd of June and the 23rd of June. And, of course, we've all got tellies, so we can do a bit of armchair astronomy, watching something astronomical in the comfort of our own home. So that's the sky at night on Sunday the 13th at 10 o'clock on BBC4, and the same channel on Thursday the 17th at 7:30, and it's entitled UK Space Engineering Special. And the BBC blurb states, Britain plays a significant role in space engineering, from its membership of the European Space Agency to its work designing and building robots that explore the solar system. In this episode, Maggie and Chris delve into the ways in which British engineering is helping us explore space, from Mars rovers in Stevenage to satellite testing in Oxfordshire. And I've already talked in this program programme, of course, about our local company are doing so well, Surrey Satellites, SSTL. I hope they get a spot on this programme as well. So there we are, Dave. That's my what's up for this coming month, June.
Thank you, John, for the fascinating insight. This show will be repeated on Monday night at 11 p.m. and is available after transmission as a podcast. The podcast will also have more items in that we couldn't fit into the broadcast.
Stars Over Surrey with Dave Jemitis and John Extell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.